blame Tim Heil and I'm an alcoholic. Since April 12th of 1990, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink of alcohol or other mood-altering substances, and that's been absolutely, positively the best thing that's ever happened to me, and it's so great to be here. I'll tell you. I want to thank Scott and Paul and Christine, who are my hosts, and everybody that puts this on. I tell you, it's amazing. I want to thank my friend Steve, who came up with me. He's kind of a backwards type of guy. I'm going to put him on decaf on the way back. But anyway, you know, sitting up here, I just kind of want to reflect on what Scott said. You know, we live in a world now that's not very nice out there, is it? It's a little contentious. It's like everybody has to be on a side, and if you're not on my side, you're stupid and I hate you. You know, and I love to sit here and watch this, because if you could see this like I'm seeing it, we've got white people, black people, brown people, men, women. We've got bikers. We've got a guy from Mongolia, for God's sakes. Right?
Right?
And I haven't seen one fight yet. You know? Tell you one of my favorite stories. My home group is the Lambton Street Group. It's in the inner city in downtown Louisville.
That's right, baby.
And because my home group is down in the inner city, probably 65% of the guys I sponsor are African American. You know, they're black men. I don't think a lot about it. That's where I got sober. That's where I grew up in AA. About 6 or 7 years ago, I was down that way, and I was driving to get up on the expressway. And right before I got on the expressway, I got hit in the rear end. And the guy that hit me was an elderly black gentleman and his wife. So we're standing in the middle of the street waiting for the police to come. Now, keep in mind, I'm only about 3 blocks from my home group. About that time, there came 2 guys down the side of the street, both black. They ran over to me. You go, hey, Tim, you all right, buddy? You all right? I go, guys, I'm all right. But at that time, 2 guys came from the other side of the street, both black men. They ran over to me. Tim, are you hurt? Can we help you? I said, no, guys, go ahead. About that time, car came off the expressway. 5 men in there, all African-American. They stopped the car, came over to me and said, Tim, is there anything we can do? I said, no, guys, go ahead. I'm okay. I didn't think anything about it. I turned around, that elderly black gentleman who hit me with standing, and he went, who are you anyway? What can I tell that guy, right? I'm just a drunk, you know? But our book says we are people who normally would not mix, right? What grows up amongst us is a fellowship that's indescribably wonderful. And, you know, it's so great. It's so great. It really is. We are so blessed. One other quick story. My sponsor is a little guy named Don M. And when I was about 5 years sober, he sent me down to Cherokee, North Carolina to speak at a Cherokee Indian reservation. And I had never spoken outside Louisville, and I was so nervous driving down there because I think I don't know what I'm going to say. And I get down there, and I'm the only non-Native American speaker. And I do not look like an Indian. And I get up there to speak, and there's the chief sitting there, and there's the medicine man guy over here, and man, I'm so nervous, I don't know what I'm going to say. The next thing I hear coming out of my mouth is, hey, you guys, you know what? When I was a kid and I used to watch those Cowboys and Indians movies, pulled for the Indians, man, I swear I did. And the chief kind of laughed a little bit, and I thought, I'm in. After the meeting, he grabs me and goes, hey, boy, we's kind of worried about you, but when you got up there and told those lies, we knew you was in the right place. You know, I love laughter in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Thank God you guys were laughing when I showed up April 12th of 1990, because there was nothing funny in my life. I love the healing power of laughter, and you've heard it all weekend, and you hear it tonight. It's so great. It really is. And man, all you new people that came down and got those big books tonight, you know, as everybody said, read it. Get somebody to read it with you. It's a journey you'll never, ever regret. You know, in the bottom line is I have to think back when I was brand new. And when I showed up, I would sit in those seats, I'd listen to the speaker, and I would listen to what the speaker did that I didn't do. I was really interested in that. So you'd be talking, I'd be listening, thinking, well, I did that. I did not do that. Next night, next speaker, you know, did it. I did not do it. Because I thought I get enough didn'ts, I'm out of here. I'm at a meeting one night, and this lady of all things is speaking. And man, I'm listening to her story, and everything she did, I did. I'm thinking, man, I did that. Oh, man, I did that too. But right at the end of her story, she said she used to carry a half pint in her bra. I said, I did not do that. I told this old guy about it after the meeting. He said, sound like you're getting a little desperate there to me, kid. And you know what, you guys, the deal was I was trying to find out what an alcoholic looked like. And you guys said, well, kind of like you, actually. I said, no, you know what I mean, a dirty old man in a raincoat. And you guys said, no, we don't know what you mean. And that night at that meeting, there were no dirty old men in raincoats. Just like tonight, not a raincoat in the place. Dirty old men everywhere, but no raincoats. But here was the thing. No matter what your stories were, you all were talking about three things. You always were talking about being restless, irritable, and discontent. You were talking about being apart from, not a part of. And you were talking about progressive patterns of dishonesty in your life. And you know what? Those three things caught me, because those three things have been part of my life from the get-go. Those three things I've wrestled with right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous for the last 29 years. You know, restless, irritable, and discontent. What is it? Book talks about it. I can't describe it, but I can tell you I got it. It's the one thing I identified with other alcoholics right away. There was something down deep wrong, and when they took a drink of alcohol, it made it all right. And I think you've heard that here all weekend. The other thing was being apart from, not a part of. You know, 29 years in the program, and there's still a little piece of me that wants to separate from the pack. There's still a little piece of me that wants to be a little different. You know, we're driving up here from Louisville, and that little voice will go, Tim, they'll know you're not one of them. They'll know you're from Kentucky, buddy, you know. There's a little bit of voice that wants to make me separate from you guys, you know, and I need to remember that because, you know, keep coming back. And staying and keeping a drunk in front of me has been the one thing over the last 29 years that I've been successful with. You know, I share this with you, too. This whole thing about, and it was talked about today, the spiritual malady of alcoholism, is that part of me that was lost, that part of me that was so yearning to find something. I love to watch movies with my 8 grandkids at Christmas time. My favorite movie of all time was E.T. the Extraterrestrial. If you remember that movie, this is about 1983, 84. I'm all drunked up. I'm out with some woman that I think I might have been engaged to, you know, one of those deals. And there's a part in the movie where E.T., the little Martian guy, gets all green, crinkly, and gray. He's dying. But all of a sudden, he looks up in the sky, and he goes, home, home. E.T. home. And I just had tears came down my face. And this girl I was with said, what's wrong with you? I said, man, I know just how he feels. And you know what? I could tell that same story in church. Nobody gets it. You tell that in an AA meeting? Oh, yeah, man. I've been trying to get home forever, you know. And the last thing you all were talking about was progressive patterns of dishonesty in your life. You know, boy, when I heard that, I was like, wow. Because I was a guy who lied when the truth was good enough my whole life. And I knew it. You know, I remember growing up, if I scored 20 points in the game, you'd say how many points you score, I'd say 24. Got to be on the test. What'd you get, Tim? B+. You know, I wouldn't hesitate. And I can remember thinking, Tim, why do you do that? Why isn't the truth good enough for you? And I almost believe today that I intuitively knew that the truth was not going to work for me. That if you wanted to drink the way I wanted to drink and act the way I wanted to act, you know, the truth wasn't going to work. you know, tell you the story. I was about 3 months sober. I got back with my family. I'm sitting up at 12:45 in the morning watching The Late Show. My 13-year-old daughter says to me, "Dad, can I order a pizza?" I said, "Oh, honey, don't do that. Your mother will go nuts." She said, "Oh, come on, let me." I said, "All right, go ahead." So she orders a pizza, 1:15 in the morning, doorbell rings. It's the pizza man. Here comes her mother flying out of the bedroom, screaming at her, "What are you doing getting a pizza at 1:15 in the morning?" My daughter said, "Dad said I could." My wife said, "You say she could." I said, "Nope." My daughter said, "Dad, you're lying." I said, "I know it. I do it all the time." You know, and I say all that to say this. Those three things, restless, irritable, discontent, apart from, not a part of, and progressive patterns of dishonesty in my life. What I know today that I didn't know when I showed up is what I just described as a spiritual malady called alcoholism and everything that goes with it, a disease of body, of mind, and of spirit. Right? And our book clearly talks about that. And the reason I like to talk about that up at the beginning is that if you're new, you know, that's the deal. And if you read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says we can't just deal with one aspect of that. Because if you do, you're just not going to be sober very long. You know, and I love the 12 steps, and I was taught that there's 12 steps for a reason, right? And the bottom line is that, you know, if I'm going to deal with the physical allergy of alcohol that I have, then I'm going to have to clean up this ugly inside that I've barely carried around with my whole life. But anyway, I'll share with you, I grew up in an Irish Catholic family. It wasn't if you were going to drink, it was when and how good were you going to do it, right? And just the way it was. And I guess I thought sometimes I want to do it better than some of these guys ahead of me, you know, no divorces, no jails, no fights. And yet all that happened and I ended up worse than anybody that come before me. But the one thing I like to share with you, because I work with a lot of young people today, is that when I was 15, 16, and 17 years old, I had dreams, I had hopes, I had aspirations, you know. I didn't want to grow up and be a drunk. I didn't want to grow up and be an AA. You know, I was a good athlete, so I wanted to grow up and play ball in college. I wanted to graduate, you know, and live the American dream, get married, have a family, coach the Little League. That would have been what I would have told you when I was a teenager I wanted. And the reason I say that is that alcohol and alcoholism would not only take from me everything that would ever mean anything to me. And the reason that's important is I didn't care what it did to you, but I was really interested in what my life was all about. And if you come from Kentucky, one of the things you grow up with, you want to be able to shoot a ball through a hoop. And I was a good basketball player. You know, I was an all-state player. My name was in the paper a lot. Picture was in the paper a lot. And all I ever wanted to do my whole life was get a scholarship to a Division I college. In 1966, my dream came true. I got a scholarship to St. Louis University, played in the same league with Louisville and Cincinnati. It was a big deal. I was the first one to go to college in my family, much less go with all that glory and notoriety. What I'll share with you, I left at Louisville in 66 to go play basketball at St. Louis, and alcoholism would jump right into my life. By the first game of my sophomore year, you couldn't play as freshmen in those days. I showed up to the first game so drunk that the other players had to hide me down on the end of the bench so they wouldn't throw me out of school. And what I'm saying to you, that was a key day for me, because the basketball would have been the one thing I would have told you that nothing can get in the way of that, because that's who I am. It's the only identity I have. And yet that day, alcohol went right by it to the top spot. And from 18 years old on, alcohol and alcoholism would dictate on a daily basis what I did, who I did it with, and especially where I ended up on any given day, right? It became the main thing in my life, and everything around that on any given day was centered around where can I get something to drink that day. As you might guess, the basketball came to an end after my junior year, and I always say the sad part about that is I didn't care. My lifelong dream, but I had found something much more interesting. I had found a way of life that I thought was so exciting, and I left it behind just like that. Now, the problem with that in 1970, I had enough credits to graduate. My grades weren't very good. I'd kind of like to keep the party going if I could. But they said, "No, you got to leave." And in 1970, the problem was they had the thing called the Vietnam War going on. That wasn't going real great at the time, as some of you remember. And they had a draft lottery where they drew your birthday out of a hat. I was number 6 out of 365. I made the top 10. So I'm going. And here's the bottom line. If you're a vet, I have deep respect for vets. I certainly was going to go. I wasn't going to run to Canada. By the way, yeah, let's hear it for the vets. Go ahead. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes.
Thank you guys for your service, all of you. Really do. But anyway, I'd already had 3 of my buddies come home in body bags, and I was like, oh, man, I'd rather not go over there if you don't mind. Now, there was only 2 ways you could get it deferred from the draft back then. You could get married. I thought, man, that's awful drastic. or you could go to grad school. And I thought, that's it. That's exactly what I'm going to do. You know, I don't know if you all remember the time in your early adulthood when you came up for the plan for your life and God was laughing his butt off. My plan was, okay, that's what I'm going to do then. And I want to tell you how the plan went through my head. And some of you are going to think I'm totally crazy. Some of the other ones are going to be right with me. Because here was the plan. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the test to get into law school. I'm going to pass the test. I'm going to get into law school. I'm going to graduate from law school. And then someday I'm going to run for Congress and someday President of the United States. Short trip for me from street drunk to President of the United States. You know? I can get there. And as you might guess, I took the test. I got a terrible score on the test, and the law school turned me down. Now, as meager as it may sound to you guys, I'm panicking because I think, Tim, you better come up with a new plan or you're going to be over shooting them up pretty quick, buddy. And it hits me. Tim, you've got the brains to get into law school. Stop drinking. Study for that test and take that test again to get into law school. And for the next 5 weeks, you guys, I didn't drink a drop. And it was awful. I had to get over the shakes. You know, I found this real smart guy down the hall. He tutored me every day on how to take this test, right? 5 weeks, no booze. I gave it the best I had in me, best God gave me. Came down to the day before the second test. I made a little change to the plan. New plan was, all right, I'm ready. I'm going to go out and have a couple beers so I can relax. Come back, get a good night's sleep, take that test, pass that test, get into law school, Congress, President of the United States. Same plan, one little upfront change there. I left Friday afternoon for those 2 beers. I didn't get back to that campus till the following Tuesday. Found out later on I rode around St. Louis on a city bus about a day and a half. And what I know today is called a blackout. And I need to tell you, I did not know what a blackout was until I got to AA. I did know I used to start somewhere, end up somewhere else with a big chunk of time going. I didn't think a whole lot about it. If that's happening in your life, that ain't right. Anyway, this is the part of my story. I think God started to have a good time with me. About 2 o'clock in the morning, I know I'm drunk. I'm not going to take the test. I go back to the dormitory. I find the smart guy, and I pay him $20 to go take that test for me. Not proud of that at all, but in those days, you could do that way too easy. So I stayed drunk for 3 days. I even forgot he took the test. 3 weeks later, we get the results of the test. The guy took in my name. The guy got the highest score in the history of the law school. It was not funny then, I want to tell you. I don't know, let's say 800 was perfect. I had gotten 350 on mine. He got 799, you know. So now here I am. I got a dilemma. And I think I better get to them before they get to me. And I made an appointment to go see the dean of the law school. So here you are, 4 short years later. This is where alcohol had taken me. I'm in this law school, dean of the law school, lying to his face, saying, Dean, probably wondering about those differences in those 2 scores. Listen, I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. I let somebody else take the test. How did he do? And he just looked at me. He never said a word. But what I wanted to share with you, the reason I remember that day, when I turned to leave that office, it went through my mind. Tim, you know what the problem is, man. It's the booze. The booze took the basketball. The booze took the law school. you should be doing both of them, Tim, and you know it. And somehow I did know it. The problem was I wasn't ready to do anything about it. I turned to leave that office. There were two guys that I know. They said, hey, you want to get a drink? I said, yeah, buddy, you bet. I need one. That was 20 years before I was going to get to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? But I can tell you this. In those four short years, alcohol and alcoholism took from me the very things I would fight you over today. Took my dignity, took my integrity, took my trust in myself and other people, took my confidence, took my security. It took those things that a lot of people refer to as moral fiber. It took those things that I think every human being, we all deep down inside, want so desperately. And the reason I say that is over the last 29 years, you all have slowly helped me get all of those things back. Slowly getting them back. And you know, I say that because it takes our marriages, it takes our money, it takes our cars, but it also takes that stuff. I think it's so valuable to us. You know, I went home to Louisville, took the draft physical. I flunked the draft physical on a congenital birth defect. I thought, man, that'd have saved me a lot of trouble, dude, you know. I got into teaching and coaching because I had a degree and I'd played basketball. The first job I had, I was the dean of students. They hired me as the dean of students at an all-boys Catholic high school. So what that school did is they hired a drunk to be in charge of discipline at their school. I'll tell you this story and you'll understand why. This is back in the 70s, right? And my job was to check all the kids in. That's back in the 70s when the kids were all hitting a few doobies in the parking lot, right, to get ready for class. And I'm sitting there one day, hungover, big old tomato head, just trying to get through to 9 o'clock. I look up, this kid standing up over me. He's got that long hair we had back in the 70s. Got that army jacket on, man. You can smell that reefer. And he's just floating over the top of my desk like this. And all of a sudden, he looked down with, hey, Mr. Ireland, you're looking bad, dude. And I think I said something profound like, hey, by God, I'm in charge here. Don't you forget that. The reason I wanted to tell you that story, listen to this. That kid said that to me that day. Next month, or in July, we'll celebrate 38 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. Good news. He's pretty much a multimillionaire, lives down in Florida. I went down there to talk a couple years ago, and he meets me at the airplane with his kids. And he comes running up and going, hey, coach, come here. He said, look, I ain't never told my kids how I was now. He said, I'll make you a deal. You don't say anything about me, I won't say anything about you. And let me tell you something. Guess where a lot of those kids have ended up in the last couple years? Right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gotten to sponsor some of the same guys I tried to teach and coach back in the 70s. In fact, if I go into a meeting in the south end of Louisville where that school was, invariably, one of them will be there and they'll jump up and go, ha, we knew you'd be here. I'd go, yeah, I knew you'd be here too, yeah. But anyway, it's been a nice healing thing for me. You know, in fact, God has given me the opportunity to redo and heal so many of the things that I fell down on so badly during my drinking days. And that's been a real grace from God to have that happen. You know, also I want to share with you, when I got back in all my infamy from my college experience, I had met my high school sweetheart when we were seniors in high school. Then I went off to St. Louis. She stayed in Louisville. And for the next 4 years, it was an on and off relationship. It was like love the one you're with, you know. And so by the time I came back after the law school debacle, I hadn't seen her in 6 months. And I was living with mom and dad, right? And I'm out one night and I run into my high school girlfriend and man, she looked good. Wow, she looked great. And she's driving this little sports car. She's telling me about this great job she has, about this great apartment she has. And I'm thinking, I'm falling in love here, I think, you know. I came home in August of 1970. We got married in November of 1970. We like to move it right along. You know how we do. And We got married in November 1970. We got divorced in 1983, but we got back together in 1985. We got divorced again in 1987. Remarried in 1990 when I got sober. Hold on. Then we got divorced again in 1995. Yeah, that's not too bad of a reaction. I tell people in my office that. They go, what? You share that in the air. Everybody goes, oh, yeah, we got it. We got it, you know. What is that? I'll tell you what it's about today. It's about alcohol, alcoholism, and everything that goes with it. I love him. I hate him. I hate him. I love him. He's good. He's bad. He's bad. He's good. You know, if you don't know, there's a thing called alcoholism in the middle of any relationship, pretty much an impossible deal, right? And you had two people actually cared for each other, had no idea what we were dealing with, drunk or sober. And that's why I have a big place in my heart for Al-Anon. Because if there ever was a family disease, you all, this is it. Let's hear it for the Al-Anon people. You know, also in our marriage, we did have three beautiful children. And how about having your oldest son born on Christmas morning, 1971? That was our gift from God. Unfortunately, I was unable to be part of that. And I was going to miss so many gifts. You know, I was supposed to be in the delivery room that morning, but the best I could do, I was in the hospital in the men's room with my head in the toilet bowl spitting up whiskey. And all I could think about is I got to get out of here and I got to get a drink. I want to share something with you. I missed the gift of my oldest son that morning. And I wasn't much a part of his life through my drinking days. When I was about 6 months sober, he was getting ready to go off to college. And he says to me one day, Dad, can I talk to you before I leave? And of course, I immediately start thinking, yep, he probably wants to tell me how proud he is of me that I'm 6 months sober. And we have our little meeting. I said, all right, son, what is it you'd like to say? He said, Dad, I only have one thing to say to you, man. I said, what's that? He said, Dad, I hate you. I hate you, Dad. Let me tell you why. I hate you because all you think about is you. Even when you stop drinking, Dad, all you think about is you. Bye. And I'm thinking, this is so unfair. A guy like me, 6 months sober, taking a hit like this? I made a bad mistake. I took this out to a bunch of old-timers in AA. They were not kind. Guy said to me, Tim, you've been drinking for 27 years. You think you get credibility back in 6 months? I was like, well, yeah. My idea was, hey, everybody, let's call it even. What do you say? Nobody was interested in even, you know? And you know what? It's still not even. And I finally realized it's never going to be even. It's going to be my job to add to those people's lives till they throw dirt in my face. And then one of the other old-timers said this. He said, Tim, you want credibility in your life? I said, well, yes, I do. He said, here's how you're going to get it, Tim. You'll get credibility by not drinking one day at a time and doing the next right thing. That doesn't even sound good to me now, you know. But you know what? He was actually right. 8 years into my sobriety, that Christmas baby called me from Seattle, Washington. His butt was on fire. And he asked if he could come home and live with me because he knew his dad was different. He knew I listened to him when he talked. He knew I was helping other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we began that healing process at 8 years sober. Now, 21 years later, I need to tell you, it's not perfect, but he has three little girls, a set of twins and a little baby girl. And I do know this, he loves every minute, every second that their Paw Paws gets to be with them. A couple Christmases ago, and here's the kids scarred by alcoholism. I've never heard him use the word love. Two Christmases ago, he cornered me and he said, Dad, I need to say this. And he stuttered and he said, Dad, I do love you. You know, here he was, 43 years old. That was the first time I'd ever heard that. But I'll tell you what, I'll take it. You know, for the last 29 years, my credibility has gotten good enough with him that he feels comfortable enough to do that. And I'm saying that because if you're new and you want it all back real quick, it doesn't happen that way. But I will tell you this. The credibility we do get back is like nothing else in the world when it comes back to you. You know, I did a teaching and coaching thing until 1980. 1980, I left, and like every drunk, you know, you got to start your own business. So I started my insurance business in 1980. Did not have a good decade in the 80s. I already told you, got divorced in 83, remarried in 85, divorced in 87, remarried in 90. I was engaged to two other women in between time. I was in the nut house three different times. I was in five major car accidents. I lived 14 different places. I had 12 different business partners. I got shot at twice, got cut up with a beer bottle, and I lost $250,000. And I was thinking, this is going okay. We're always like the last to know, man. I don't know what that is. From 1982 to 1985, I went through five psychiatrists. That was a simple deal. I kept him till he started talking about alcohol. They talked about alcohol. I fired him, got me a new guy. I took every antidepressant they ever made, drinking whiskey and beer on a daily basis. If you're using that recipe, it didn't work real great for me, you know? New Year's Eve, 1985. Living with mom and dad again. You know, I used to run into guys I went to high school with. They'd say, hey, man, what are you doing? I'd say, I'm president of my own company. They'd say, no kidding, where are you living? I'd say, mom and dad. But New Year's Eve, 1985, that was the day. Because no matter how much whiskey I drank that day, the thrill was gone. And some of you know what I'm talking about. My friend alcohol that I had found when I was a teenager was never, ever going to work the way I remember how it worked. The book talks about we can't live drunk, we can't live sober. And that was the dilemma I faced that day. It was a scary moment. And that was the time, that was my first visit to the asylum. My brother drove me over there. And I'll share this story with you. Someday I'm going to find this nurse and get her side of the story. But as I remember it, I'm as suicidal as I've ever been. They put me in the detox room. And I'm sitting there, and this nurse comes in and says, honey, tell me about it. I said, okay, I will tell you about it. 2 years ago, my first wife left me for no reason that I can think of. And then I got engaged to this other woman, and she took off with a ring, and I haven't paid for it. Oh, yeah, and I tell you, my daddy went to prison when I was 12, and I didn't know where this stuff was coming from, but I tell you, I did know I was feeling better as I kept talking. About 2 hours into it, she looks at me and goes, well, honey, you certainly have a right to feel the way you do. I thought, lady, you are so right. If people mess over you like they messed over me, by God, you drink too. I spent the next 16 days in there trying to help everybody else. I did. I thought God sent me there on a mission. They made me head of the stress class. I got a ribbon for the best ceramic and shop, you know. I was killing it in there. I was doing so well that halfway through that state, a nurse says to me one day, would you like a pass out tonight? I must have thought she said, you want to pass out tonight? I said, what? She said, yeah, you can go out for a couple hours as long as you're back by curfew. I call my best buddy, picks me up to Nut House. We go right to the watering hole. Slam down 6-8 beers, got a couple shots. I bought this big old bottle of wine. I'm telling about all the people I'm helping back the hospital. Quarter to 11, I said, hey, man, I got to get back. I got curfew. Got to be responsible here. He drives me back to the Nut House. I'm getting out the passenger side to stumble back in. I look back in, and he's got tears coming down his face. I said, what is wrong with you? He said, Tim, you don't belong in there. I do. And I said, you know what? I think you're right. And when I get out of here, I will help you. All right. And you guys, I came out of there and I did what I always did. I started over. Got me a new girlfriend. Got me a new place to live. I always started over. If you listen to our stories in AA, best starter overs in the world. Can't finish much of anything, but we flat start over, baby. You know. I got back with my most frequent wife, as I call her, and when I came out of there. But as the old timers will tell you, wherever you go, there you are. And she threw me out of late in 1989. I spent the last 6 months of my drinking in a guy's basement in the south end of Louisville. I can't tell you anything fantastic happened there. I can tell you, April 12th of 1990, I got up. Actually, I came in that night about 3 a.m. They were all in bed, the family I lived with. There were three beers left in the refrigerator, and I drank those. And I sit on the edge of the bed, my clothes. And I thought I was having a heart attack. You know, I didn't know what. I was queasy. I was tingly. I've never had the feeling since. But I guess I passed out on the bed that night and woke up the next morning about 5 a.m., sit on the edge of the bed, and I had the same queasy, tingly feeling. And I remember dropping my head and saying, God, I am so tired. I've lost everything again. I've lost my wife. I've lost my kids. I've lost my home again. Please help me. And I got up, got dressed, and I went in my office. And you all, I'm in an office that's very busy. Usually the phone rings all day. Usually there's people in and out of that office all day. April 12, 1990, I sit down at 7:45. I didn't move a muscle till noon. The phone never rang one time, and nobody came in the office that day. And I guess it's that moment of clarity that the book talks about, because all I could think about, Tim, it's over, and you know the problem. And I reached my desk drawer, meeting directory of Alcoholics Anonymous, which a guy had given me 2.5 years before. It was right there the whole time. And I went to a meeting that day. And I want to tell you this in summary. From that day until tonight, the last 29-plus years, man, I tell you, it's been quite a ride. I have laughed sometimes harder than I think I could stand. But I also need to tell you, I've cried more tears than I thought a man like me could cry. I have felt fear and anxiety. You heard about that today, like I didn't think I could handle. And the reason I like to mention that is that when I was new, I was kind of hoping this sobriety thing was going to be about the absence of problems in little Timmy's life. And you all said, oh no, little Timmy, who told you that? Little Timmy, what sobriety's about is that you're going to get to be part of life. And Tim, you're going to get to be there in body, mind, and spirit. That really rang a bell, because if you read our book, it says we have a threefold disease. It took me a while to get this part of it, how damaging my disease was, even when I didn't have the alcohol in it. Because my wife used to say to me, Tim, you're not even here when you're here. I'd say, what do you mean? I'm here. But you know what? If you can only bring your body and you can't bring your mind and you can't bring your soul, you can't be a husband, you can't be a dad, you can't be a granddad, you're just a body in the room. And I didn't get that peace. I didn't get that peace. It took me a while in Alcoholics to understand why we have 12 steps and why I had to continue to seek a higher level, a higher ground, so I could be fully present in my own life, not only in body, but in my mind and with my soul. And I tell you what a reward. I told you I have those 8 grandkids, right? And I don't miss a trick. About 6 months ago, there's 3 12-year-olds, and I sat on the floor and played Monopoly with them for 3 hours. A guy like me couldn't give you 3 minutes of his attention. Because my disease, you all, was I was either drinking, thinking about drinking, or thinking about me. And that doesn't leave any room for anybody else. And that's the disease of alcoholism in a nutshell. And that's why, thank God, I've had the tutelage in Alcoholics Anonymous to continue to stay in that book, continue to work those steps, and continue to ask God, as it says in 6 and 7, to relieve me. You have the bondage of self, so that I could participate as a father, as a grandfather, and as a friend. You know, I'll share this with you. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that first time, I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't have a home group. So I certainly didn't get near a step. And the first 14 months, I was drier than a bone and angry, so angry. And if you'd approached me about that time and said, hey, Tim, are you happy, joyous, and free? I'd say, yeah, you idiot, you know. And I ran into this little guy, and I couldn't go to sleep at night, you know, in early sobriety. And he would tell me, said, Tim, just lay there and go, God is love. God is love. God is love. Still do that sometimes. But 14 months drier than a bone, God is love was not getting it done. Now, if I thought, I call that little sucker, he gives me God is love one more time, I'm going to knock him out, you know. I called him, and sure enough, he said, Tim, God is love. I said, I know that, man. but I'm so angry and I am so depressed. And he went, good, 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 good. Don't you hate old timers? I said, what do you mean good? He said, Tim, in Alcoholics Anonymous, God is love, but love is action. God is love. Steps 1, 2, and 3, your powerlessness, his power. Step 4, your simple responsibility to clean up your mess. Steps 4 through 9, the simple responsibility to clean up your mess. Step 10 is a refresher course every day. Step 11 hooks you up with your God. Step 12 hooks you up with us. Tim, what do you say? I said, yes, sir, I got to do something. Because I'm either going to kill myself or I'm going to kill you. And that was the day he sent me down to Lambton Baptist Church, and I became the coffee maker there on Wednesday morning. And that was the day he put me into a men's big book group, which this very day meets every Wednesday night, 5:45 to 7 in my office. And that was the day I found out the greatest secret in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what that is? Found out where the fun is, man. The fun is in the middle. The fun is in the middle with people who do stuff like this. It's in the middle where people who get hands-on in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they get on committees and they do the service aspect of it. You know, and Debbie talked about it this morning. If there's anything that I think we need to reinforce today in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the service aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, because it took a long time. But it took a long time for me to understand the concepts in the big book. But it didn't take me long to understand, move that chair. Move that chair. Take that guy home. And I say that very sincerely because, you know, those were the things that kept me in the loop in early sobriety. You know, also, when I, as you heard in my little diatribe there, when I got sober, I owed $250,000 to people who really wanted it back. And I thought that was awful. I'm trying to get sober and everything, and all I could think about is money, you know? And I tell you what, I'd come into my office every day, and I'd start shuffling papers from one side to the other. Of course, I'm a drunk. I'm trying to think about one big deal, right, to come up with $250,000. And that self-centered fear would set in. And by 10 o'clock, I was back in my apartment, crawled up in a ball. And it's happening, you guys, every day. You know, I'm just getting shut down by this fear. I'm at a meeting one night. I'm sharing about this to this old man, and he says, see me after the meeting. So I see this guy after the meeting. He says, what's your problem with your business? I said, oh, man, I'm going to go bankrupt. These people are all over me for this money. I just don't know what to do. He said, tell me about your business. I said, what do you want to know? He said, just tell me about it. I said, all right. Well, it opens at 8 o'clock. He said, good, Tim. He said, good, Tim. Be there at 8 o'clock. Not 8:05, not 8:10. Tim, you be there at 8 o'clock. What's next? I said, well, I'll go on sales calls. He said, good, Tim, go on sales calls. What's next? I said, well, I go to lunch. He said, good, Tim, go to lunch. Tim, come back from lunch. Great point, man. And what's next? I said, well, I come in and I do my paperwork. What's next? I said, well, work's over at 4:45. He said, good, Tim, go home. Have dinner with your family. Go to your meeting. Come home, say your prayers. And then he hit me. He said, and Tim, do the same thing the next day. And I was like, wow, what a concept. You like, do that every day, huh? You know, and what that old guy was telling me, my sponsor Don's giving it a name. He was saying, Tim, your job is to do the stitches and you leave the patterns up to God. You do the stitches, Tim, and leave the patterns up to God. You know, you guys, what happens when I start thinking about that? I start thinking about stitching. I start thinking, what's this going to be, a hat, shirt, pants? And when's it going to be done? They said, no, no, man, you just stitch. We promise you the patterns will be so much greater than you would ever imagine. So I started doing it, right? Getting there at 8, going to my sales calls, going to lunch, coming back from lunch. It ain't working. You know, I'm 6 weeks into this. I still owe $249,720. I'm going, this is a slow process. But anyway, I didn't have any choice, and I kept doing it. I'm going to tell you the sequel to the story. 5 years later, I come in from my office one day after my home group. Six messages there. Five of them from AA guys. The last one was from a reporter at our business paper in Louisville. So I called this lady, and I said, yes, ma'am. She said, Mr. Highland, we'd like to do an article on your company as one of the fastest growing of its kind in the Louisville area. I'm like, well, gosh, thank you very much. That's very nice. And so I said, what is it you'd like to know? She said, sir, what is it that you did that really turned your business around? Oh. Now, I had one story, how I came up with this great idea, pulled myself up by my bootstraps, and rocketed this company to success. That ain't what I told her. I said, lady, here's the truth. My office opens at 8 o'clock. I get there at 8. I go to sales calls. I go to lunch. Come back from lunch. I went through the whole thing, right? And like there's at the end of it, there's like silence on the other end of the phone. She said, thank you, sir. We'll see what we can do. And you guys, I knew there was not going to be an article, but I also knew that that's my job. You know, Don tells me every day to ask God, what's the next stitch in my personal life? What's the next stitch in my business life? What's the next stitch in my AA life? And you know what? It's always right there. The trouble with the stitches with me, I'm a big deal guy, right? And the stitches aren't. They're little bitty, simple, next right things. And when I'm stitching, not worrying about the patterns, it's the best life is for me. You know, the best it is for me. You know, we laugh about in Alcoholics Anonymous about relationship problems, and I don't know if that we're any worse than normal people. Yeah, we are. We're a lot worse than normal people. But I will tell you this, you know, there was nothing funny about those divorces. Getting a divorce when you're drunk is one thing. Losing your marriage in sobriety, a whole different ballgame, right? And when I lost that marriage at 5 years sober, I was distressed because I thought, man, I'm trying the best I can. And I came to you guys. You guys said, oh, Tim, we don't know, buddy. Just keep helping drunks, right? Just keep helping drunks. So I kept helping drunks. You know, I did that. I've always done that. But 1 year went by. I'm helping drunks. 2 year goes by. I'm helping drunks. And I think, gosh, I don't mind helping drunks, God, but I sure like a female partner to help drunks with. Boom, there she was, man, right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, almost immediately. It was unbelievable. It looked like one of the best matches in AA history. She was 5 years more sober than me. She was involved in the program. So, heck, we did the mandatory 3 months. We got married, you know? It lasted 8 months. Now, I'm going to tell you, when this marriage went down, it went down in flames right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was embarrassing. It was just awful. It was awful for both of us, right? It's a long story, but we've since made amends, and we're actually friends today. But it was awful. It was ugly. And now I'm on my knees, almost 10 years sober, saying, God, what is so wrong with me? Why am I so broken? And you guys kept saying the same thing. Tim, we don't know, buddy, but keep helping drunks, right? Keep helping drunks. It's going to be okay. So I kept going, and I had to tell you, a funny thing happened to me on the way to long-term celibacy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was like living with mom and dad after that, and I got a call from my most frequent wife, mother of my children. Remember her? She was down in South Carolina, had the kids down there on vacation. I guess she heard what happened. She said, you want to come on down, spend some time with the kids? I said, yeah, that'd be great, thank you. And I drove down there and got a separate place from when they were staying. Now, here are two people, known each other since they were 17 years old, been married and divorced 3 times at this point in time. I went down there that weekend. And for the first time ever, we agreed to be friends. For the first time ever, we agreed to be co-parents and co-grandparents. And for the first time ever, the wall that was always so high didn't seem quite so high anymore. There was an ease and comfort between us that we hadn't had before. I came back to Louisville. I started dating her. We never really dated. We got married a lot, but we never really dated. And I would take her out one time a week, you know, and I did that for 6 to 8 months. And then finally I sold my place and I moved in with her and we were living together. And just about 17 years ago, I guess it is now, we were sitting there one night. I looked at her and she looked at me. I said, hey, what do you think? This coming November will be our 49th gross wedding anniversary. I have no idea what the net is, by the way. I got to tell you this. We went to our 50th high school reunion a couple years ago. And we walked in and everybody went, oh, look, they're still together. No way I could tell them that story, right? I will say this, though. You know, I said to Don, my sponsor, I said, is this pretty crazy? He goes, yeah, Tim, it's crazy, but maybe not. Because if our program's about anything, it's about transformation. And you know the thing about transformation? We don't know when it's going to happen. We don't know how it's going to look. And we don't know who's going to be involved. You know why? We don't transform. God does. You know, and that has to be what's happened here. Because I tell you, we are the best of friends today. I miss her every time we're not together. We do everything together. We have, told you, 8 grandkids and 2 great-grandchildren. And we're living such a beautiful life. And sometimes even when I tell this story, it doesn't even seem like that was real, although we all know it was. The bottom line is, somewhere along the line, through all that havoc and all that turmoil, God changed 2 people so that they could finish their life in a loving, caring way. So when I say this, there was a little lady in California who heard me speak one time. She said, Tim, you know, when I listen to your story, it seems like you always thought you came to a period in your life. She said, Tim, God doesn't use periods. He only uses commas. And if you out there right now think you're at a period in your life, you're not. There's a comma there. The problem is God doesn't share with us what's behind that comma, does he? What he tells us is we got to suit up. We got to show up. We got to stay sober. Stay on the firing lines of life. But the promise is, sooner or later, you're going to find a new freedom and a new happiness. I'll finish up by telling you this. You know, I had those 3 beautiful children, right? I had 2 sons, and then I had my baby girl. And my baby girl was her daddy's daughter from the get-go. When she was a toddler, her first little phrase was, I'll do it myself. Her second little phrase was, is you're not the boss to me. And I knew from the beginning, oh, man, here we go. By the time she's 12 years old, I'm finding 6-packs in her backpack. I'm finding 0.5 pints in her shoes. I'm chasing her all around Louisville, getting her out of jail for shoplifting. Game's on, man. My little girl is just like her old man. She drank like me. And let me tell you about this child. Beautiful child. Tall, blonde, blue-eyed. Gifted athlete. Gifted artist. Whatever she wanted to do, she could pretty much do. But she loved to drink. And she loved to party. At the end of high school, she got a scholarship to the Art Institute in Chicago, and she went up there, and she was well heavily into her drinking. I knew that. She stayed there for about 2 years, then left and went to Los Angeles to the Second City. She got into performing arts. You know, it's the same deal that John Belushi and all those guys were in at one time. And I knew she was in Los Angeles, but I knew this. I knew she was living in her car in the streets of Los Angeles on a liquid diet. Because in addition to her alcoholism, she had an eating disorder. And that's not a good combination. Not a good combination. And I guess it's about 17 years ago now. She came home finally, and I hadn't seen her. We hadn't seen her in 2 years. And I want to tell you the vision. My baby girl's hair was all matted to her head. Her eyes were caved in. Her cheeks were collapsed. Her teeth was rotten out. She was so thin you could stand there and count her ribs through her T-shirt. She was dying. Between the alcohol and the eating disorder, her body basically was disintegrating. It was starting to consume itself. And I'll never forget, I saw alcoholism clear up and close because I said to her, honey, is there anything that we can do to help you? And she looked at me with those steely alcoholic eyes and said, Dad, if there's anything you can do for me, I will let you know. Bye. And she got in that car, and they went back to Los Angeles, you all. And I knew it was only going to be a matter of time before that phone rang because she couldn't live very much longer living in that car on a liquid diet. And 5 weeks later, the phone did ring. The good news, it was her. The bad news, she was so weak by that time, she was whispering. And now, you guys, I want to tell you, I was 12 years sober, and I help a lot of people. But when it's your baby girl and she's 3,000 miles away and you can't get to her, it was a moment that I'll never forget. It was a whole new surrender because she said, Daddy, what should I do? And if you're a daddy, all I could think about is I'm going to get on an airplane, I'm going to go to California, and I'm bringing my baby home. And what went through my mind, Tim, is what do you think about the A&A now, buddy? Good enough for her? And what about those 12 steps you're always popping off about? Is it good enough for your little girl? And here was the big one, Tim, what about that God you're always talking about? Is it good enough for your little girl? And guys, I need to tell you, it wasn't, it didn't seem to be. But for some reason, what I said to her, honey, here's a man's phone number in Los Angeles in Alcoholics Anonymous. I pray and I hope you will call him and ask him for help. You know, I hung up that phone and I sobbed for 2 hours or more because I'm thinking it's 50-50 whether she makes the call or I go out there and bring her home in a box. But I also can tell you, I knew somewhere down in my heart that I had offered her the only thing that in the history of mankind, really, and especially for the last 84 years, has ever worked for people like me and like you. And that's called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only thing that consistently and persistently has saved the lives of people with alcoholism. And somewhere in my mind, I heard you all saying, Tim, anytime, anywhere, someone's reaching out for help, the hand of AA needs to be there. And what I had given her was the hand of AA when I gave her that phone number. And I knew it was going to be okay either way, whether I brought her home in a box or whether she made that phone call. And I know that's not easy, and I know a lot of you out there have lost your children. I talk to people. Every time I talk, somebody comes up and tells me. But the bottom line is, as I said, the only thing I know that consistently and persistently has worked for us, and I'm very, very happy to tell you that that little girl did make that call. In this coming July, she will celebrate 17 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that little girl is the same little girl. Come here, honey. Come here. Active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She sponsors a lot of women, and I am so grateful. And I want to finish up by saying thank you for my life, thank you for her life, and please keep coming back. I told you I have those 8 little grandchildren. I've already picked out 2 of those little suckers. I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks.